You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. On March 27, 2015, Captain Scott Kelly docked at the International Space Station. That trip wasn't his first mission to the ISS, but it would be his longest and most trying assignment, lasting a record-setting 340 days in an environment that is utterly hostile to human life. For NASA, measuring the effects of a long-term space voyage on Scott Kelly's mind and body was an essential stepping stone in the path toward a manned mission to Mars. For Kelly, though, it was a remarkable test of will as he persevered through the devastating physical effects of zero gravity, radiation, and high carbon dioxide levels, the isolation from everyone he loves and the comforts of Earth, the catastrophic risk of colliding with space junk or becoming untethered during a spacewalk, and the still more haunting threat of being unable to help should tragedy strike at home. He's written about his record-breaking voyage in a new book appropriately titled Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. And today, Captain Kelly joins me on the podcast to talk about the experience. He shares how that year in space pushed his body to the limit and why the hardest physical test was coming home. Scott reveals how he combated boredom and homesickness and what he missed most about life on Earth. He discusses the geopolitics of a joint space mission and getting along with his Russian crewmates. He also tells me if a man can ever get tired of looking at the Earth, what space smells like, and the weird things it does to your feet. Coming up with astronaut Captain Scott Kelly in just a moment. Scott Kelly is a former military fighter pilot and test pilot, an engineer, a retired astronaut, and a retired U.S. Navy captain. A veteran of four space flights, Kelly commanded the International Space Station on three separate expeditions, including a year-long mission to the space station. Now that he's back on terra firma, Captain Kelly has written a fascinating account of his experience up there, titled Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. Scott, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, and I have to say I was a little bit surprised to read in it that you originally didn't want to do any missions to the space station because you said, to use your words, you didn't want to get the space station stink on you. Was there a time when the International Space Station was considered a dead end for an astronaut?
Well, you know, when I became an astronaut, the space station didn't exist, and we were flying the space shuttle. At one point, we started building the space station, and, you know, I think a lot of people in the early days, at least, of the space station, when they got assigned to those flights, they kind of felt like they were missing out on a shuttle mission, especially once the retirement date was set. So, you know, it was, it's true what I said, but it was also said kind of in jest.
Yeah, and one of the key reasons that you were chosen for this mission is, I guess, because you have a twin brother named Mark, who is also an accomplished astronaut, and I guess this would allow NASA to compare the control Kelly on the ground with the experiment Kelly up in the space station. How was it decided which one of you would actually go up to the space station for a year?
So I was assigned to this flight, and then once I was assigned to the mission, due to a question that I asked about genetic-based research, I asked if NASA was interested in doing anything like that, really to get me. I was getting prepared for a press conference, and, you know, they initially said no, but would you be interested? So The scientists went back, talked about it, and decided there was merit in this idea of this genetic-based research. But it was a serendipitous thing. I was assigned to the flight, and then later we started talking about the fact that I have a twin brother who was also an astronaut. Would this be a good idea as an experiment? Now, my brother had already retired from NASA, so there was no real decision like who would be the control and who would be the, you know, the test subject in space.
I see. Now, did you ever wish that you were the Kelly who got to stay on Earth and eat Doritos on the couch?
No, I didn't wish that. I think I had the better job in the
yeah.
deal.
You say in the book that you almost missed out on the mission because I guess NASA had concerns because you had had prostate surgery and some vision problems on the last mission. Is that right?
Well, I had in 2007. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and I had it, you know, my prostate surgically removed. And after that, with the help of the flight surgeons at NASA, specifically my flight surgeon, Dr. Steve Gilmore, but other people helped as well, I was able to get re-qualified for space flight and flew 500 days in space after I had cancer.
Now, the whole purpose of this mission was to test the long-term effects of space on the mind and body. Even with all of our technology, space is an extremely hostile environment for the human body. Does it take a special kind of masochism to want to take a mission like this on?
In our office, in the astronaut office, there are a lot of people that would have done this flight and could have done it. So I don't think I'm any more special than any of my colleagues for doing this. I feel privileged to have had the opportunity. Like you said, space is a harsh environment. We get a lot of radiation in space. The microgravity environment itself has other negative effects. So, it is a difficult, challenging place to live physically and mentally, but a lot of people could do it.
One of the more interesting chapters in this book is actually before you even get up there, you talk a lot about Star City in Kazakhstan, which is the Russian equivalent of Cape Canaveral, because we retired the space shuttle, so all of our astronauts have to hitch a ride up to the International Space Station with the Russians. Now, the Russian cosmonauts have all kinds of funny superstitions and rituals before launch. I was amused particularly by this strange tradition where the Russian cosmonauts apparently stop on their way to the launch pad and urinate on the back tire of the bus, even the female astronauts. And did you ever get an explanation of the origins of that tradition?
Yeah. So we all do that. And it's because on the first flight of a human in space, Yuri Gagarin needed to use the restroom and there wasn't one available on the way to the rocket. So they stopped the bus and he got out and opened up his spacesuit and used the bus's tire as a tree. So we do that now on every single flight from Baikonur.
They also, I guess, plant a tree for every cosmonaut that's gone up at Star City. Do you have a tree as well, or is that just for the Russians?
No, they do that for Americans. I hope my tree is still alive. it was kind of small the last time I saw it.
Well, it doesn't take very long to get up into space, but apparently docking at the space station is a whole other story. Is that one of the hardest parts?
In the space shuttle, it's a complicated piloting task. A lot of it's done manually by the shuttle commander. The Soyuz is generally automated, but at times they take over the cosmonaut, who's the Soyuz commander, will take over manually and dock the Soyuz manually.
So once you board the space station, what's the hardest thing to get used to physically in space? I mean, obviously gravity, but what else?
Well, the lack of gravity makes most things harder to do, except, you know, moving around heavy objects because they don't have weight. They still have mass. But, most stuff is harder to do. And also because of the absence of gravity, you have the fluid in your body shifts upwards towards your head, which makes for an uncomfortable feeling for, pretty lengthy time, actually.
Yeah, you said that due to the high carbon dioxide levels, I guess you had headaches, congestion, nausea, that type of thing?
Never nausea, but headaches. Rashes. Yeah, headaches, congestion, eyes irritating when the CO2 would get on the high side, not all the time, but you know, at times it's elevated and it's not a pleasant feeling.
Is sleep deprivation a big problem too?
You know, some people have challenges sleeping in space. You know, our whole lives we slept on a bed, hopefully, you know, in between the comfortable sheets with a pillow to put your head on. And, you know, when you no longer have that, it makes challenging. It's like new challenges sleeping, not having that kind of pressure and the fact that you're floating.
But you don't have to worry. I guess you're cocooned from the sun, though, so you don't have to worry about the sun coming up 16 times a day, do you?
No, not in the U.S. sleeping quarters. The Russians, though, they have two sleeping quarters that actually have windows in them. Now, I would imagine when they're sleeping, they have them covered up.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference between the American quarters and the Russian quarters?
The U.S. ones are quieter. They're a little bigger.
Okay.
Having said that, though, the Russians, they have a window.
You know,
we don't have a window. I think their ventilation is a little bit better. But,
really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And they have a big vent on the ceiling that's more like a giant faucet.
It
just blows air down on you.
I think of Russia, I think of, you know, tanks, you know, just rotting away in a yard somewhere and that type of thing. I don't think of them as having better technology than us usually.
Oh, I didn't say it was better.
Oh, okay. Well, you did say that, I guess,
they had a window and a fan.
Yeah. Because you did say that the Russian cosmonauts also, I guess, their spacesuits are pretty much held together with rubber bands or something.
We wear the same spacesuit. You know, we wear that spacesuit as well. And they do seal it with rubber bands, which is a statement on their, you know, practicality in doing things. So,
yeah,
you know, at times maybe not as, you know, technically advanced as you may think, but certainly.
But it does a job.
Certainly practical.
From a psychological standpoint, there's no such thing as out of sight, out of mind when you're on the space station because, you know, the Earth containing everyone you love is right there every single day, really not that far. I mean, shorter than driving distance between L.A. and Vegas, and yet your world's apart. That must lead to a especially torturous brand of homesickness, I guess.
Yeah, you are, you know, you're close in miles. You know, the space station is only about 250 miles above the surface. But from a, you know, conceptually, you feel much further away because you do understand you're going really, really fast, 17,500 miles an hour. And getting back to the back to Earth is not only a risky proposition, but it's also, you know, very lengthy and complicated. And it's not like you can come home whenever you want. So having the Earth there with everyone on it, all 7.5 billion of us, does give you a feeling of detachment from the planet.
It must seem to some extent like kind of life goes on Earth. And did you feel like you were getting left behind at times?
You know, we have the ability to stay connected to the planet pretty well with email and phone calls. We have a phone we can use basically, you know, anytime we have a connection, which is about, you know, 45 minutes of every hour. We have the ability to do video conferences. So I would never say, you know, I really felt like, you know, life was continuing on Earth without me. No, I never felt that way. I felt, you know, fairly connected to my friends and family. You know, at the same time, you are detached from a planet that has mostly bad news emanating from it.
I guess you don't have too much distraction. It's not like you can go out and have a beer or anything. Did you ever feel kind of the opposite of that, like you were bugging people on Earth too much, your relatives?
The only time I ever felt that way was you know, after my sister-in-law was shot and Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was shot. And I spent a lot of time trying to support my brother and call him and see how he was doing. And I think after a few weeks, I felt like maybe it was more he was supporting me in space than I was supporting him. So I kind of laid off a little bit.
You know, speaking of homesickness, do you miss just the simple things like the basic physics of Earth life? You know, being able to sit down, being able to not have your dinner floating away?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I mean, I miss sitting at a table with utensils and gravity assisting in the whole activity more than I did miss any kind of particular food, as an example. So
really,
Yeah, you do miss earthly things like that, like eating at a table.
Yeah, and when you're going through all that, did you ever feel, I guess, like maybe the guys on the ground at Mission Control didn't have your back, or like they didn't have quite enough empathy for all that you were going through for them?
Well, you know, first of all, it's a pretty hardcore place, right?
Yeah.
You're in this risky environment with radiation, and microgravity causes some negative effects on our physiology. There's, like you mentioned earlier, the carbon dioxide that sometimes gets high. You know, I think it's kind of human nature in difficult situations to sometimes feel sorry for yourself and, you know, try to blame, you know, whether it's a organization or people or whatever. And, you know, there were times I felt like, you know, maybe the ground wasn't really listening to me as much as they should have with things like the carbon dioxide. But, you know, in hindsight, and when you go back and, you know, consider the challenges that they have, you know, they don't only have to worry about the guys on the space station now. They have to worry about this program over the course of years. Mm-hmm. So there are, you know, complexities and challenges that are a result of, you know, having to maintain this hardware operating for longer periods of time than I would even seem that I would even consider or think that's important to me.
During your year in space, at any point did you use the phrase, well, why don't you guys come up here and do this?
No, I never.
No?
I never said that. Okay. And I always felt like it was a privilege to be there. So, you know, on one hand, you know, might not feel good on certain days. On the other, it was a privilege. And I tell those stories not to point fingers at people, but I just wanted this book to be something that when someone read it, they could say, wow, you know, I really felt like I was in space with him. Mm-hmm. I feel like I understand the program better, the challenges, the goods and the others. You know, not everything's always great. And I think to have a balanced story, you have to touch on, you know, all aspects of it.
And among the hard times that you had to deal with, at one point, I think 3 resupply missions got canceled, including 2 vessels that exploded. Were you at any point getting concerned that your resources on board were starting to dwindle?
Yeah, so when we got up there, we had lost one previous to our launch in the year prior. So that was the first failure.
That was the SpaceX one?
That was the orbital.
Oh, okay.
That failed right after liftoff. Mm-hmm. And then we had SpaceX, and we also had a Russian Progress resupply craft that both of those didn't make it while we were on board, while I was there with, you know, my astronaut colleagues. And we were starting to get concerned about supplies. Had we lost the next resupply spacecraft, we would have been in some more serious issues. But fortunately, it made it, and we were okay.
Okay. So you had stockpiles to hold you through it, huh?
Yeah, and NASA plans for that. I mean, that's part of our planning process, is to plan for failure and then have you know, redundancy to carry us forward.
What about the dynamic among your crewmates? Do you have the typical roommate problems, like someone eating your food or not doing their share of the chores?
You can. I mean, I was lucky in that my you know, my fellow crew members on all my flights, I always got along with great, you know, very professional and great people, and really a privilege to fly with them. But, you know, at times when you're in any kind of closed environment with people, you know, I'm sure I irritated my fellow crew members as well. So there are those kind of things that happen, but, you know, we figure out how to move past them. And
well, because you're also dependent on each other.
Oh, absolutely.
You talk about having to cut each other's hair, and apparently even you did dental work on each other?
Yeah, I've never cut hair in space because, you know, I don't need mine cut, so.
Right, right. There's no reciprocity.
Yeah. That would be a real crappy job to have to give haircuts when you don't have hair.
Yeah. What kind of dentistry did you do?
I had one of my fellow crewmates, one of his teeth fell out, so we had to glue it back in onto a post.
When you're sharing close quarters with the Russian counterparts at a time when the U.S.-Russian relationship was particularly tense, did you guys ever talk about politics, or did events between Obama and Putin ever create friction?
Never friction. Mm-hmm. Occasionally we would talk about our country's relationships, but in this kind of a detached way, almost like, you know, the American astronauts and the cosmonauts were talking about the relationship between, you know, China and France. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't really have a personal stake in this conversation. And we wouldn't really dwell on it for a long period of time, because what's important to us is our ability to work together, our cooperation, our ability to take care of one another, our ability mm-hmm. to, you know, we're putting our lives in our own hands in space, and that was much more than any yeah. politics.
I read that you do have concerns that Putin could retaliate for U.S. sanctions by cutting off NASA's access to the Russian space program. If he did that, I suppose it would sort of be like holding the space station hostage, because we have no way of getting up there right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, there is that concern. Do I think it'll happen? Probably not. You know, the Russian Space Agency also relies on NASA for a lot of things. We provide their segment of the space station with electricity, for example. We have a lot more ability to produce power. So where they, you know, provide transportation services at a cost, we also provide certain things that to the space station that they cannot.
I don't know if this is something that you can talk about, but I wonder, are there classified projects that the Russians and Americans work on separately on the space station? And do you maybe have to worry about crewmate espionage, if so?
Well, I can only speak for NASA, and I have never worked on a classified project on the space station. And I would have to refer you to the Russian Space Agency for the second part of that question, because if it was classified, by definition, I wouldn't know about it. I wouldn't even know about it, because it'd be their classification.
Yeah. Now, how many hours of spacewalk did you do, and what was that like?
Yeah, I went outside three times, I think, mm-hmm. for, you know, probably about 20 hours worth. It's type 2 kind of fun. Type 1 kind of fun is the roller coaster when you're doing it and you're like, "Wee, this is fun." Type 2 fun is it's fun when it's done. You know, it's kind of hard.
You live to tell the story.
Yeah, exacting, challenging work, and you might not be the happiest while you're doing it, but when you're done, you're like, "Man, that was awesome."
Is there a very real fear of getting untethered and floating off to space when you're doing that?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it would not be a good day if you floated away. In the U.S. spacesuits, we have a jet pack. You can fly yourself back. I wouldn't want to try it. Depending on how quickly and how fast you're moving away, it can be a challenge even in training to get back. But, yeah, we're concerned with us floating away, with our tools or the hardware you're working on. So everything always has to be tethered, and it's very exacting.
Yeah, you don't want to create any more space debris.
No.
We have enough already. Is that a big concern when you're up there?
There's a lot of
getting hit with space debris.
The space station. Yeah, the space station gets hit all the time.
Really?
You know, fortunately, we have good debris shielding, so we've never had anything penetrate the hull.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Captain Scott Kelly when we come back in just a moment. How do you combat space boredom? Do you just fill all your hours with work, or how do you pass the time?
Mostly with work. I mean, our work day during the week is well over 12 hours.
Wow.
We do a lot of exercise. You have to exercise a lot in space, or you lose bone and muscle mass.
Yeah.
But also you find other things to do. I mean, in your spare time, I took a lot of notes because I thought I might want to write a book someday, so I kept a journal. Of the experience. You read a little, you watch movies or TV shows. I saved Game of Thrones to binge watch in space.
How about video games? Do they have video games on the ISS?
You know, we do on the laptops. I think you can get them, but I've never played one or seen anyone playing them.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically living one. So.
Yeah, right.
Well, you also say that you brought along Ernest Shackleton's biography, and you even named your own biography after his ship, the Endurance. Of all the explorers, why do you feel a particular kinship to Shackleton?
Well, I just think he was a great leader, and what him and his crew were able to accomplish in the Antarctic, being, you know, marooned and survive well over a year and not lose one person. Mm-hmm. No one died, is really a testament for, you know, Shackleton's leadership and the crew's ability to survive in some incredible circumstances.
You also took a bunch of pictures while you were up there, and I think you're going to follow up this book with a book of your photographs from space. What was your favorite view of the Earth?
I think one of the most beautiful views is of the blue waters of the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. It's so expansive and blue that it's hard to, you could never confuse it for anything else. But there are other beautiful spots on Earth as well, other tropical waters. Deserts are incredibly beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that the places where people generally don't live, in water or in the desert, is the places that are most appealing looking from space. The forests don't really transmit well through the atmosphere. They don't look as brilliant as those other places.
Could you see evidence of man-made pollution from up there?
Absolutely.
Really?
Certain parts of Asia, India, Eastern China, almost always covered in pollution.
Wow. Astronauts always talk about this feeling of euphoria that you get when you look down at the Earth, but does the overview effect start to wear off after 341 days of looking at it?
Some people have termed this as an overview effect or the orbital perspective, this idea that when you're detached from Earth and you're looking out at its beauty and you're considering that, everyone who's lived and died is basically down there. It makes you, I think, more of a empathetic person. So what I would say is, as the longer I stayed in space, the more of that kind of feeling I had.
Really?
Yeah, that orbital perspective, this change in your feelings towards humanity, I guess, would be a good way to put it. But on the other hand, looking at the Earth for a long time, even though you appreciate its beauty, you do sometimes kind of get used to the view a little bit.
Yeah.
You think you may not, but I kind of did after a while.
I mean, it makes sense. You get used to anything. At a certain point, you're like, oh, I'll look at Facebook instead.
Yeah, let me take Mona Lisa off the wall and I'll put something else up here.
Exactly. Well, when you came back, I wonder, was it harder adjusting to life in space or readjusting to life on Earth?
I think readjusting to life on Earth. Living without gravity for that long made coming back to gravity, I think, more challenging than the transition the other direction.
Yeah, I imagine it must be like physical therapy, probably. Almost.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you have physical reconditioning, which in a lot of ways is like physical therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you open the book by recounting, I think it's your first night at home, when your ankles start swelling up and you have a rash, you're nauseous. And that has to be particularly scary because no one has experience with this. You can't just walk into an emergency room.
Yeah. Well, we also have good medical care. But the fact that, I knew why I was feeling this way meant that, I didn't need to go to a hospital. I would just talk up to my NASA physician about it in the morning. But if I would have felt these symptoms and had not been flying in space previously, I absolutely would have went to the emergency room and said, I don't know what's wrong with me. But
are there still any things that trouble you a year or so later?
Nothing, physical symptoms.
Yeah.
I would imagine, based on my previous experience, that I still have structural changes in my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably genetic damage from radiation, which we all get all the time. Our body generally does a good job at repairing that damage. So, hopefully it won't have any long-term implications. But we do get a lot of radiation in space.
When you say structural damage to your eyes, what do you mean?
Swelling kind of the optic nerve, something called choroidal folds, which are folds in the fleshy material that's part of our retina.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I hope it was worth it. What kind of things did we learn from this experiment?
Well, there's all kinds of experiments we do on the space station while I was...
Right, yeah. Right, in the moment, yeah.
So there was like 400 different experiments while mm-hmm. I was on the space station, and some of those involved me as a human subject compared, you know, Misha and I compared to other, you know, astronauts, but we've been in space for longer, my mm-hmm. brother compared to me. And some of those results are available. There's one about our telomeres.
Oh, really?
Which are...
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, these parts of our chromosomes.
Yeah. They're part of what keeps us, you know, gives us shorter or longer lives, they say now.
Yes, yeah.
So what happened to your telomeres after that?
So, yeah, so as we age, as we get physically older, our telomeres get shortened in length mm-hmm. and they get more frayed. The hypothesis was that, you know, me in space, radiation environment, stressful environment, everything yeah. that goes with that.
Makes sense.
Would cause my telomeres to get shorter compared to my brother's mm-hmm. on Earth, or compared to mine on Earth, for that matter, from when I launched. The reality of it was they actually got better.
Really?
Which was surprising.
Do they have any idea why?
Who knows? Maybe it was a clean living or something up there and all the exercise.
Yeah, speaking of clean living, I assume that that's a pretty sterile environment. Does it take a hit to your immune system when you come back down to Earth and are exposed to pollen and that sort of thing and germs and whatnot?
Dander? Yeah, I think that's part of your, you know, not feeling good when you get back. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe some of the nausea. I kind of felt like I sort of had like flu-like symptoms, you know, wow. of the first few nights really? Back. So I think that's probably your immune system reacting to something in Earth's environment that you didn't have, whether it's germs that are new to you or something else, who knows?
Are there things that were accomplished or learned during that year, particularly with the experiments on you and your body, that have direct applications to getting us to Mars?
Well, that's the idea, and I would imagine so. We have this issue with our vision that is potentially a problem. You know, you don't want astronauts going on a long mission and having blind spots when they arrive yeah. on, you know, wherever they're going. So, you know, I hope some of those results and some of the other experiments will help mm-hmm. future long-duration space travelers. But the way science works is, you know, it's a long process. I think they're still in the analyzing the data phase. And generally with, like, human research experiments that NASA does, the results aren't published until years later.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're still in the early phases of this.
Somewhere I read that when we do send people to Mars, you said you bet that it'll be a crew of old people. Why is that?
Well, when you get out of the magnetic field of the Earth, you get exposed to a lot more radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a lot of radiation in space now, but away from the Earth, it becomes even a bigger problem. And I was just joking because, you know, if you're older, you can... Your radiation limit, this part isn't a joke, your radiation limit is higher the older you get because you have less time to develop a fatal cancer as a result of that radiation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, makes sense. You know, if you're going to get a lot of radiation and you're older, you're better at dealing with it because you don't have as much time for it to become a problem.
Yeah. Funding runs out for the space station in 2024. What do you think should happen to it then?
I hope they extend the funding to it mm-hmm. and, you know, allow NASA to use it as a laboratory and a place to continue to do research until we get to the point where we're going somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
whether that's the moon or Mars. I don't know what that will be, but I do think we need a destination and goals, and we have to continue to fly people into space because we don't want to lose that expertise. It's too valuable.
And you talk about your youth and how you were inspired by reading the book, The Right Stuff, but you say that you weren't a great student growing up, and yet you went on to accomplish some pretty amazing things. How do we rethink education so that we get kids like a young Scott Kelly interested in STEM subjects to get us to Mars and beyond down the road?
So my experience was that it was impossible for me to pay attention mm-hmm. growing up. And I can remember every year at the beginning of the school year, I would say, okay, this is a year I'm going to get my act together. I'm going to do my homework. And that lasted generally about 2 or 3 days. And then it was back to my normal state of looking out the window or just looking at the clock, hoping that I could will it to run faster and not being able to pay attention. And I truly felt like it was impossible for me. Like if someone had held a gun to my head, I wouldn't have been able to do my homework or pay attention to what the teacher was saying. And it wasn't until I found something that I really, really wanted to do. I wanted to do it so much, it required me to fix that attention problem at least enough to where I could become a better student and learn. And it's, you know, thinking back on it, I'm kind of surprised really how it worked out because, you know, I read a book. I decided, okay, I'm going to do this. It wasn't the easiest thing. It was probably one of the hardest things I've done is teach myself how to pay attention. You know, I came from a pretty significant deficit when I started college and to just catch up and eventually become an engineering major. You know, it's interesting. I went from, you know, bad student to first guy in my astronaut class, first American in my astronaut class to fly in space. That took me about, let me think, you know, less than 20 years, so about 17 years.
Yeah, I guess it's just finding your niche, something that motivates you.
Yeah, exactly. A spark really is what I needed. So, you know, to answer your question about, you know, helping kids and that might experience the same kind of issues I had, you got to find what motivates them and what their spark is. And it's not just telling them that they have to pay attention because this is important.
What's the thing that surprised you the most about the experience?
You know, how long a year is. It's a really long time. You know, the whole space station program and NASA has surprised me in how, you know, I truly believe now that if we have a goal, even if it's a goal we think is impossible, but we work really, really hard at it and we're committed to it and you get the right people involved, that we can solve, you know, our problems, whatever those problems are, because the space station, the hardest thing I think we've ever done, and if we can do that, we can do anything.
What's one small thing or one overlooked quirk of living on the space station that probably wouldn't occur to most of us here on Earth, but maybe got your attention or maybe even amused you at some point during that year?
You know, a lot of people think that because you float, that you would, you know, move around with your hands and you could go without legs or feet. But actually your feet become very, very important because they hold you in place when you're trying to use your hands. So to keep your body stable, you have to use your, you have to secure it some way. And you do that with your feet. And the longer you're up there, you know, the more comfortable you get at it. And eventually you're just holding yourself in place very subtly with your big toes and maybe just one big toe, and how important that toe becomes to you, so much so that you get big callus on the top of it. It kind of gets
on the top.
Yeah, it gets pretty nasty.
Yeah, I think you say the bottom of the feet after that long becomes like a baby's bottom.
Baby.
It's so soft.
Yeah, you get baby feet.
No use.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I have a listener, Joe in Chicago, wants to know, what does space smell like?
To me, it smells like welding or maybe a sparkler on the 4th of July, kind of like a burning metal smell.
Yeah.
It's sort of an appealing smell. It's very distinct.
Yeah.
Some people characterize it more as a sweet smell, like some kind of food or something, but I think it smells more like burning metal.
How about the noise? Is it noisy on there?
Yeah, it can be noisy.
Really?
You know, occasionally I would wear earplugs when I slept just to give my ears a break. But there's a lot of, you know, pump and motor and fan noise in the space station. Some spots, you know, louder than others. Our crew quarters are relatively quiet, but still, you know, there's still fan noise in there from the fan that blows. You know, you need to circulate air in this enclosed space.
Yeah, and I was interested that you said that it's not that cramped.
No.
Wasn't that claustrophobic on the space station. Pretty roomy?
Yeah, there's plenty of room. Mm-hmm. Soyuz is kind of small.
Yeah.
It's actually not kind of small. It's actually very small.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't look, the Soyuz doesn't look that much different from the first rockets that we used.
Yeah. It's a tiny capsule.
Yeah. Now, do you think you'll ever go back up there? I'm sorry, does your girlfriend over here agree?
Yeah, my fiance. She would, I think so.
Yeah.
She'd probably let me go.
Do you want to go? How about the first couple in space? Has that ever been done? Yeah, you could do all kinds of interesting experiments then. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. Once more, it's called Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. Captain Scott Kelly, thanks for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Captain Kelly for joining me on the podcast. Order his book, Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery, on Amazon, or download the audiobook at audible.com. Keep up with Scott at scottkelly.com and follow him on Twitter at @stationcdrkelly. Also, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. And please take a moment to take our listener survey at podsurvey.com/kick so we can get to know who's listening, and it's also helpful with our advertisers. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @kickassnewspod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.